The Nobel Peace Prize-winning medical assistance organization, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has just published a grim top 10 list. It's the top 10 humanitarian crises of 2008, the latest in an unfortunately ongoing series of emergencies in medicine, violence, malnutrition, disease, and natural disasters. And joining me now to discuss the list is Nicolas de Torrente, who until last Friday was executive director of the American branch of Doctors Without Borders, but still with the organization?
Yes, Leonard, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And I'm so pleased that you could come back. What criteria do you use to determine the severity of a crisis? I would think there's you could have done a top 25 list even more.
Sure, it's quite hard actually to rank these disasters, and we do it on the basis of the experience of our field teams who are working in about 60 countries around the world. And it's really the, you know, our perspective is the humanitarian perspective, so what people are going through, and we try to see the rank, you know, the severity, the magnitude, the scope of the disaster. And this year we have, of course, a number of conflict situations, about six of them, in fact, many of them in Africa, Somalia, the Somali region of Ethiopia, the Sudan, the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. We have Iraq and Pakistan, where things have escalated quite a bit. And then we have two issues that are more, you know, the actions of repressive governments who kind of neglect their own population. This is Zimbabwe and Myanmar. And then two major health crises, which are the toll taken by malnutrition among young kids and the co-infection between HIV and TB, tuberculosis.
And they cross national borders, so
they're
not
like
specific
thematic
any place.
That's right.
But why do you think so many of these crises are in Africa? I mean, Africa is it's been predicted again and again that Africa will be the future of the world, and it's so much has been done to try to improve the situation there. Why does this continue?
Well, what you see in many of these conflicts are clearly the result of major governance issues, unresolved kind of problems of representation and legitimacy of, you know, who has authority, who governs, who is in charge, and that's what we're seeing definitely especially in these large countries where there are different ethnic groups. There's a history, of course, of colonialism and post-colonial struggles of after post-independence. So this is a very poor continent overall with mineral and natural resources, which in fact in many places are more of a curse than a blessing. Okay. So that destabilized the situation further.
Part of the value of a list like this is that it brings attention to crises that might have slipped off the media's radar. Have you ever determined why some crises get more attention than others? For example, there was a recent article in the New York Times that questioned why Darfur has received more attention than the much worse situation in eastern Congo. Now, Darfur is pretty bad, but eastern Congo, or Congo itself, I think, has lost more people. More people have died as a result of the civil wars there than in any war since the end of World War II. We took millions of people, and it hardly gets any mention.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. And I wouldn't want to rank Darfur versus the eastern part of the Congo, but
we're talking thousands as opposed to millions.
Well, actually, there are over 2.5 million displaced in Darfur. There have been definitely tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of deaths. So it is an extremely serious situation. Crimes against humanity have taken place. So it is a very serious, an ongoing problem. I think that in the Congo, one of the issues is that it's a very multi-layered and complex problem. I mean, there are a variety of political, historical, economic issues, and you can't really find an easy narrative of, you know, the good guys versus the bad guys, kind of a black and white kind of rhetoric, which in fact is something that has been applied to Darfur, where it has, you know, the conflict has been largely portrayed as the Khartoum government and who have largely committed most of the atrocities, but really a very one-sided kind of narrative of massacres against a defenseless civilian population, and that, you know, that tends to be easier to understand and to portray and to communicate, and I think that's one of the issues at stake here.
This is your 11th annual top 10 list. How many of the crises have carried over from previous versions?
Well, actually, you mentioned the Democratic Republic of Congo. I think we've done it for this list for many years, and virtually every year the Congo has remained on the list. I mean, there have been moments where we thought things would improve. There have been, you know, lulls in the fighting. There have been political processes. You know, there were foreign armies visibly present in the Congo who have left the Rwandan forces and the Ugandan, at least, you know, they're no longer visibly present there. They still have influence for sure. There have been elections, so we thought things would get better. But especially in 2007 and 2008, a new war has really reignited in the eastern part of the Congo, and we again have hundreds of thousands of people on the run, an ineffectual UN force that's unable to protect the population, that is siding with the government, in fact, and kind of a contradictory mandate there. So, and very little aid available to people outside the provincial capital of Goma.
Looking over the various lists, do you see any situations that have improved to a point where you wouldn't even consider a place for inclusion?
Well, it's, you know, those are the difficult calls that we have to make. I mean, we, you know, we had, for instance, Haiti on the list for many years, since 2004, and after President Aristide was removed, there were lots of, there was, like, you know, kind of urban guerrilla war in Port-au-Prince, and UN forces again involved there. That was on our list. Haiti was hit bad by a tropical storm last year. We had, you know, major response to that, and there's still, we have still major programs there, and the health needs are tremendous in terms of victims of trauma and also obstetrical and any really health services in the capital of Port-au-Prince. But compared to the others, it didn't rise to that level. So it has, if you might say, it has improved somewhat. Although for the people who live there, it still is it's far from ideal.
My guest is Nicolas de Tourente of Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. We're talking about the top humanitarian crises of 2008. This is the 11th list, and it is rather depressing, unfortunately. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There seems to be more funding being provided for global health than ever before, and yet health indicators aren't necessarily improving. Why do you think that is?
Well, there is, and it is a positive sign. You asked for hopeful things. I mean, I do think that there is, of course, a lot more awareness and a lot more funding and attention to global health issues. Some of it takes time. I mean, we are talking about major imbalances in research and development, for instance, and the health needs of poor people in poor countries have been neglected for years and years. And so we're still struggling, for instance, and one of the issues we highlight in our list is to find a diagnostic tool for tuberculosis, for instance. We still use in the field a sputum test that was invented in the 19th century. That is the main means that we have to detect tuberculosis.
People spit into a cup.
They spit into a cup and try to analyze it. But with HIV patients, AIDS patients in particular, they are, you know, they're unable to spit up in a way that is lends itself to detection very easily. And so we struggle to even know whether they have TB, and it is one of the leading causes of death among our AIDS patients. So there's a major imbalance that's going to take time to redress and a time for R&D efforts to bear fruit.
There are also cultural resistances to things like taking the HIV test, aren't there?
Well, there's been a major change in that respect. I mean, there's a lot more treatment available, and prevention efforts have also increased significantly, and increasingly we're moving to a kind of an opt-out system, so where patients are, or where people are tested unless they opt out, as opposed to the voluntary counseling and testing method where you had to opt in. So actually, testing has increased quite a bit. Although you're right to say, and I was in Zimbabwe last summer, and I was still struck by the level of stigma and discrimination, and the fact that people were hiding their status and because they feared to be ostracized and discriminated against.
And Zimbabwe now is facing another terrible crisis, cholera, which is taking many lives. And the president, the embattled president Robert Mugabe, is now claiming that the cholera epidemic was somehow manufactured by the British government.
Well, he blames most problems in the country on the British government. The fact of the matter is that it's there are serious political problems in Zimbabwe, and there's an economic meltdown of kind of unimaginable proportions, with inflation of 230 million% a year, I mean, this.
And we thought Iceland was bad with 17%.
Well, I you know, when I was there, I could not imagine. You know, you had the price. Basically, it means that the price of goods doubles every day or every other day. So there's money is worthless, and people are fleeing in great numbers, and the economic infrastructure of Zimbabwe, which used to be very good, is collapsing. And that, for instance, there is no money to buy chlorine to chlorinate the water that is distributed in the through the water pipes in the capital Harare. You see, you know, pools of water because there's no maintenance of the water system, and so you have stagnant pools of water. You have contamination of sewage between the sewage system and the water supply, and that is what's leading to a massive cholera outbreak that Zimbabwe never experienced before.
Almost every one of the crises we've discussed has had a political component. How does the organization Médecins Sans Frontières navigate that? Because you can't operate unless the people who are often responsible for these crises even allow you to.
Right, and that's one of the major problems that we face. One of the biggest issues that we have, of course, is that the problems we're trying to deal with have often political roots, and they are caused by the very authorities who hold control or hold sway over that population.
Or allowed to continue, as we saw in South Africa, where there was people in government who were suggesting that garlic would cure HIV. Well, they said that HIV didn't cause AIDS and garlic would cure AIDS.
Right. So what we have to do, I mean, in the case of access in a conflict zone in particular, where massacres have happened or people have been forcibly displaced, and the government of the country who controls access is responsible for it, we have to try in a way to convince them to allow us in on the basis of our humanitarian work and the identity and the fact that we don't have any other agenda that is attached to it, which of course they fear very much, a political agenda, economic, religious kind of destabilization, and they fear exposure. And of course that is something that we will do, and we will talk about the conditions that we experience. And so that is one of the reasons why governments sometimes don't want aid organizations, independent aid organizations, to be present.
So when you publish a list like this, are people back in the countries that you are pointing a finger at then likely to come back to you and say, you know, you said we were responsible for this terrible crisis in our country, you got to leave?
Well, this is, you know, it happens that we end up at a breaking point with authorities. We are in tension with authorities very often. We still manage to have a dialogue. We still manage to try to, you know, make our case that we are really there for the best interest of the population, and we don't want to have any further involvement in the broader political context. We don't, you know, don't take sides in the conflict. We don't take sides in the war, and so on. But it, you know, this year, for instance, the government of Niger stopped our program that was dealing, which was a very big program dealing with malnutrition. And we were treating tens of thousands of malnourished kids. And one of the reasons we think is because the mere fact of treating these kids and providing them with effective therapy was in fact exposing the problem of malnutrition, which is an invisible, a hidden problem that the government would rather have go unreported, because of course there's a bit of a shame attached to the fact if you're a government and you're unable to feed your own population. They don't want that to be known very much. So we think that's one of the reasons why that program was stopped, unfortunately.
And NGOs like Doctors Without Borders are often the targets of the other sides in these conflicts. In fact, in a number of cases, Afghanistan, elsewhere, you've been forced to cease operations for a time.
That's true. In terms of the obstacles that stand in our way, there is, on the one hand, kind of the administrative and other blockages, denial of access that we referred to earlier. And then the other big issue, of course, is violence. And we know that in any conflict situation, there are risks attached to trying to provide aid, you know, in a conflict area, in a war zone. What is more disturbing is what you refer to, which has developed in recent years, which is really the targeted attacks at aid organizations and aid workers.
Because they want to keep the bad situation. They don't want things to be improved because that undermines their cause?
That is a potential motivation. There is the motivation as well of seeing aid organizations as kind of extensions of the Western, in particular, a Western political agenda. We see these targeted attacks happen very often in places where there is an international or a Western military presence, an international strategic and political agenda. And aid organizations in those places are often perceived to be kind of extensions of that or implementers of that. And so attacking them is a way to score political points against this.
Is that what happened in Iraq?
For sure, there have been and there have been many statements made by militant groups saying, you know, the U.S. is portraying its war as a war of for human rights and humanitarian values and so on, and therefore we will attack the aid organizations who seem to be promoting that agenda.
Now, you were offering health care in Iraq, a country that had had a very viable health care system before the war. Is the Iraqi government likely to be able to revive that health care system?
Well, there's definitely...
Have the doctors all fled?
Well, many doctors have fled. There is the Iraqi Medical Association estimates about 50% of the doctors have left the country, especially specialists, people who could, you know... were unable to continue to practice for security reasons, for reasons of threat, and also just for economic reasons, and so have left, but in particular for political and security reasons, and have left. There is a very strong basis for reviving that healthcare system, and that's the quality of the staff and the personnel and the infrastructure that still remains. And so I think it could be turned around if the security situation improves and there's a political will attached to that.
Has Médecins Sans Frontières returned to Iraq?
Well, we had to leave in 2004 because of the security risks that we talked about earlier. We then approached the conflict in a way from the periphery. So we set up surgical facilities in Jordan and in northern Iraq to deal with complicated reconstructive trauma surgery for trauma victims who could no longer be treated inside of Iraq. And so that's what we've been doing. And recently we've been, as the security situation has improved somewhat, have been able to assess the possibility of returning including international staff inside Iraq.
And would you work with the Iraqi Ministry of Health?
Well, sure. We work with all, in every place we work with our colleagues are the medical the health professionals, the medical aid providers, and the Iraqi Ministry of Health or any other Ministry of Health would be just a natural partner for us.
My guest is Nicholas de Torrente, the former executive director of Doctors Without Borders. He's still with the organization, but in another capacity. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can you tell me a bit about how Médecins Sans Frontières was founded in 1971? Why was there even a need for it? Isn't the International Red Cross supposed to take care of these things?
Well, the origins of MSF were that were at the time of in the early 1970s that they were in relation to the big humanitarian disaster of the time, which was the war in Biafra, the secessionist war there in Nigeria. And in fact, the first doctors who went out with, who then founded MSF, went with the International Committee of the Red Cross and came back. There are different stories. There are different sides to this story. It's actually a more complex story than that. But they did come back with this idea that to complement the work of the International Committee of the Red Cross, it would be good to create an organization that would be based on the same principles of the Red Cross, which we have, which are neutrality and impartiality and independence and so on, but to really have a focused medical mission and really focus on the medical aspect of the work.
And first, it was just French doctors.
That's right. In the beginning, but the spread of the organization was contained in the name itself. I mean, when you call yourself Doctors Without Borders, it's kind of a paradox. It was founded along national lines, first in France, and then we had sister organizations founded in Belgium, in Switzerland, in Holland, and first in Europe, and then kind of an international expansion in the late 1980s.
Do you find that doctors are Do they offer their services? Is that how you get most of the doctors who work for you?
Yes. Well, I mean, we're based on the principle of voluntary work. So people volunteer to their time, their effort, their skills, their expertise. We do now compensate them. So they do get stipends when they go out, and later on get salaries.
But originally they were doing it totally.
There was always a bit of a stipend from the beginning. But the idea is that it's, of course, people are doing it because of their commitment and because of their willingness to help, as opposed to being employees of a company that is providing medical services.
I'd also imagine that because of the stress of this kind of work, that there's a fair amount of burnout.
Yes, and absolutely, and these are very stressful situations to work in and to be in, and it's often hard to predict actually how one will react to being in a conflict area. I mean, I've been in places where I did just fine, and in others where maybe that were even less dangerous, but that I found more difficult to cope with, and that affected me far more. I felt more insecure in.
Well, you can't just send the doctors into these crisis areas, not all of them with wars, but most of them seem to have some kind of armed conflict. But you can't just send people in. You have to prepare them, don't you?
Sure.
How much can you prepare them?
You can. I mean,
Do you teach them languages, or is that a luxury that you can't afford?
We actually don't teach people the local language necessarily. I mean, when we work in a Francophone country, we send French speakers, or in a Portuguese speaking country like Angola, we send Portuguese speakers. But the preparation is really a kind of an induction and a mental kind of preparation to what it might be like, and asking questions and trying to get a sense of it. It's actually hard to. We don't do much technical preparation ahead of time. People have their professional expertise, the medical professionals in particular. We do technical training for logistical staff, administrative staff, financial staff. But there's not much you can really do to prepare yourself for what it might be like. I mean, I remember going out the first time. I was told I was going to go to a refugee camp in Kenya. I had no idea really what a refugee camp was like, and it was nothing that I could have read or I could have been told what could have prepared me to see what I did see. So I think you have to go and experience it.
How did the local medical populations respond when you show up? Do they see it as competition, or, oh, gee, thank you, we really need the help?
Generally speaking, they see us as an added resource and added help, and the cooperation at the doctor to doctor or medical staff to medical staff level is good. It gets more tricky the higher up you go, because when it comes to the issue of medical policy, which drugs should be prescribed, which medical approach should be taken, which vaccination coverage should be provided, and there when you deal with more of the policy making staff, even in ministries of health, there can be differences of opinion.
So we're talking about another kind of politics that has to be taken into account.
Sure. I mean, we talked about the issue of malnutrition earlier in Niger. I mean, we are fighting to get a policy change in this area to introduce better methods and products to treat and now prevent malnutrition with these what are called ready-to-use foods that do not need to be cooked or prepared, or water does not need to be added, and that can be distributed to young growing kids, because these foods meet all of the nutritional requirements. Now, for us, we can provide this, and we can do it also because we have our own budgets to do it. For a Ministry of Health to switch policy and to introduce this on a large scale does mean, training their staff, changing their protocols, needs identify funding for it. So it's actually more difficult for a Ministry of Health to change policy. And we found this to be the case when we tried to introduce new malaria treatments, for instance, and use more effective drugs. It's actually not easy. There is inbuilt resistance to change for understandable reasons in government ministries of health.
And then in some countries, there's fear among the population that these drugs might have negative effects. Sometimes rumors spread that it will make you lose your ability to have children, and or they're infecting us with diseases instead of curing us of diseases.
That's true, and those are, I mean, there is a health education component alongside all of the programs that we implement, and that's a necessary one. Sometimes, you know, you have to. There are certain things that cannot be changed in the perception, in the attitudes, local attitudes, which are that we have to accommodate rather than try to change.
My guest is Nicolas de Torrente of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. You mentioned Pakistan. This is a country that doesn't normally, well, only recently has started becoming a trouble spot in other ways. An increase in the number of suicide bombings. Many health clinics are shutting down their operations for fear of becoming targets. How has your organization handled that?
With great difficulty, because it is, as you mentioned, it is a country that we were not used to work in. To operate in, because it hasn't had the kind of issue necessarily that we would have been able to respond to in the past. We've been very concerned about the increase in fighting in the, especially on the Afghan-Pakistan border, between government forces on the one hand, militant groups, Taliban-type groups on the other, and there, on top of that, there are U.S. airstrikes, as you know, that are targeting accused al-Qaeda militants who are holed up in that area. And so that is actually, there has been quite a bit of attention to the politics of all this. What has been less reported is that it has led to actually a big impact on the civilian population. We have hundreds of thousands of people who have been forced to flee these areas where there are a lot of violence is going on. They're living among the host population. They're living in schools, in mosques, it's been very difficult for us to assist them because there's not been this widespread understanding of humanitarian work, of foreign organizations coming in to provide help, and quite a lot of suspicion to overcome to be able to establish programs in that area and threats to kind of avoid. So, but we are operational. We are providing aid to the displaced. We are providing medical services, ambulance services.
In fact, the government gave you special dispensation, didn't it, regards to the ambulances?
We've managed to establish in part in Swat, which is one of the valleys. So it's a very complex area with every, you know, a sub-region with its own cultural and political and social dynamic. So in one area, we've been able to have with a lot of methodical work and explanation and building up of networks, we've been able to establish an ambulance service that is respected and ongoing, yes.
Well, in places like Pakistan, where some of the more radical groups are targeting Europeans, as we saw in Mumbai, for example, doesn't that cause a problem? Do people see you as agents of imperialism?
Well, that's a concern, definitely. And so for us, the biggest, the most important thing we can do is to distinguish ourselves and to try to really make it clear that we do not form part of this kind of a broader Western agenda. That we're not agents, as you put it, agents of imperialism or of U.S. or European interests, but that we really are there just for the medical and humanitarian work, which is, you know, it's something that cuts across cultures, cuts across political, but it's something we should all be able to agree on, is that people who are caught up in these situations should be spared from the violence and should be assisted. It's a, you know, that's the basis of humanitarianism. It's a very, very simple and should be quite compelling idea, so we need to convince of that.
Two of the things we have talked about a lot on this show as a result of some of these awful situations is that sexual violence is often a major component, and the other that child soldiers are enlisted. Are these things that your organization gets involved with?
Definitely sexual violence, because, as you mentioned, in many contexts, it is one of the, you know, one of the most terrible features of war, and especially of the way wars are waged against the civilian population, and especially against the most vulnerable groups, women and children, and women in particular, in the case of sexual violence. So the place where it's actually the most visible, the most acute, is in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, eastern part, and we have an approach which is, of course, to provide medical services, also counseling services to women, and the numbers are staggering. I mean, it's we treat hundreds and hundreds of women a month in our programs there, and there's an ongoing, you know, impunity. Perpetrators go unpunished. There is a lack of basic respect not just of human life, but also of human dignity, and this kind of self-perpetuating cycle of that, and something very difficult to break.
Your top 10 list describes Somalia as an almost impossible place to deliver and administer aid. Why is that?
Well, the situation in Somalia has really worsened a lot in the past 2 years, and you know, there's a lot of attention to the piracy, and there's what's going on off the waters of Somalia,
which we had hoped to talk about.
Yes, I would have been very interested to hear the comments. What's going on inside the country is very troubling. What's happened is that in the course of 2006, there was a broad array of groups that came under this banner of the Islamic Courts Union, and they established some relative stability in the southern part of the country. There were also some accused terrorists who were Al-Qaeda members who are part, were kind of harbored or were staying there. And that was deemed to be unacceptable by the U.S. The Ethiopians were very concerned about their national security. And there was a government in waiting that the UN had created in neighboring Kenya and had never really established its authority. And so you had a convergence of these different political agendas, and that led to an internationally sanctioned regime change, which has been nothing short of catastrophic, because this new Somali government was installed in Mogadishu, but it led to huge fighting, hundreds of thousands of displaced, massive destruction of the capital city, and a humanitarian disaster.
And the Islamic courts actually have made a major return, control
That's
of
right.
a large part of the country.
They've come back in the past.
And Ethiopia, which was seen as the stronger country because it was involved in the invasion attempt to stabilize Somalia, it's having its own problems. It's on your top 10 list as well.
Well, there's kind of a parallel conflict, and it's one of the reasons why Ethiopia actually intervened in Somalia, which is they're having an internal conflict in Ethiopia that is in the Somali region of Ethiopia. And that conflict, one of the reasons why they intervened in Somalia was to prevent Somalis from participating in that rebellion.
Do you think that the spillover from these sorts of things will destabilize neighbors like Kenya and Yemen?
Well, what we're seeing for sure is that Somalis are trying to flee the country, so they're coming into Kenya in much greater numbers, and they are also taking the very treacherous trip to Yemen. So they're desperate to flee. They feel they have no choice, and so they embark upon these very small boats at the mercy of human smugglers. They get thrown overboard. We have over 40,000 people have attempted this crossing in extremely dangerous conditions, and we often find their bodies on the beaches of Yemen.
We have less than a minute, but I wanted to address Myanmar, which has a number of crises, some of them natural disasters exacerbated by a repressive government.
That's right, and what we're attracting the attention to in this report is really the utter neglect by the government and the international community of the health needs of the citizens of Myanmar, especially around HIV/AIDS and other health needs. And so there's been a lot of attention to the victims of the cyclone, and the situation has improved quite a bit in that area, but in the rest of the country is still in a desperate state.
Now, Nicholas, if people want to try to help and want to get involved with some of the work of Doctors Without Borders, what do they do?
Well, they can visit our website, which is www.doctorswithoutborders.org.
So they don't have to know how to spell the French version.
No, it's fine. English is fine. And there's a lot of information there and different ways to help out.
And we also have a link to that on our show page at wnyc.org. You're no longer the executive director. What are you going to be doing?
Well, I'm embarking upon a research project that has to do with our relation, MSF's relation with these global health institutions, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, the Gates Foundation, and taking them into account because they are a big force on the field right now.
Nicholas de Torrente of Doctors Without Borders, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much, Leonard. Thank you.